Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for September 2nd, 2021, heading into the home stretch here, coming up into the fall season of this year. I don't know where this year has gone. If it's like me, we're in a time warp. It's just flying by day after day. I was like, today it was like 1 in the afternoon. I don't know, where did this day go? I just don't even know. It like went zip, like half a second long, and it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Time is, it seems to be contracting. Maybe we're accelerating faster and faster, closer to the speed of light. No, I'm just kidding, but it just seems like time is just flying by. Like in the old movies where they had the calendar and it was like the pages would flip off the calendar and blow off in the wind. Wow. Okay, well, what I'm talking about lately is electric highways to the stars. And last week, I left off on a topic called specific impulse, specifically talking about it's a property of physics. And it's kind of a strange thing because it's in unit of seconds. And you would think that an engine in space would have maybe momentum or energy or velocity or something, but no, in units of seconds. But if you understand what it really means, it's kind of like the efficiency of a jet propulsion system, including the payload. In other words, how well does this work? And it's used comparatively. It's used to compare to other rocket designs. And so when I designed, for example, my electric propulsion systems, they turned out to be exceptionally good space vehicle propulsion systems because you do not have to carry payload of fuel. And I described last week, and I've talked about this many times, about the so-called rocket problem, that if you build a bigger rocket to carry more payload, or the other way around, say you have a big rocket, it works well, you want to add 1 pound of payload to your payload to get it up into outer space. And so you go, okay, well, just add a little more fuel for that. And now you have a problem, though, because you added, say, a pound of payload, but now you have to add the fuel to get that extra pound into space. Well, that extra fuel becomes payload. And so you're not adding 1 pound to the rocket. You're adding, let's just as an example, say it takes 20 pounds of fuel to get that 1 pound into space. You've just added 21 pounds, not 1 pound. So you can see what's going on here. It's called the rocket problem. And that's why vertical lift, heavy lift rockets will not get us very far in outer space. We can get up, you know, a couple hundred thousand pounds. That's a pretty good payload. But when you're talking about getting up payload that is big enough to house 100,000 people, then 100,000 pounds is not a lot. It's pretty little, because to support a single human being in outer space, you need some very good, quite a bit of space. But you not only need space, you need infrastructure. You need support systems. This person's got to eat. There has to be waste management. There has to be food grown. Oxygen has to be regenerated from carbon dioxide. The respiration process has to be supported. And so all of this has to be supported. And, of course, the way they do this in low Earth orbit is they can ship all this stuff up there. And it can be recycled, etc., to a certain degree. But most of the stuff is replenished with trips from Earth. But if you start getting into autonomous space stations, and that's where this is all going, because the idea is that if you leave Earth on a voyage around the solar system for, you know, and you won't be back to Earth for a number of years, then all of this has to be autonomous. And then this is the downfall also of people trying to go to Mars, because they're using the Earth-supported model of space travel. And of course, they're trying to get away from that a little bit, but they're really nowhere near the autonomous point of view yet. Because, like I say, you have to get a lot of structure up there, a lot of infrastructure to support this person living in outer space with all the things that you have down on Earth, including, dare I say, toilet paper or whatever they use. You know, all of this stuff has to be managed. And, you know, the clothing, changes of clothes, you know, how do you shower, you know, you're, like I was saying, breathing, just breathing, the basics, human necessities, take a lot of infrastructure. So for every human pound that goes into autonomous space travel is very different than a human being in low Earth orbit, where you can resupply it every month. You can shoot up another spaceship full of stuff and take away the other stuff, the refuge from the space station, all the candy bar wrappers and I don't know whatever else they have up there in outer space, Tang wrappers, Tang bottles, I don't know, whatever, you know, whatever they have in outer space, you got to get rid of that stuff. So they bring it back, or they probably shoot it into the atmosphere and nobody knows about it. But anyway, autonomous space travel is a whole different ball game. So anyway, the amount of stuff you can get into outer space is really the essential factor in how far can you go in outer space, etc. So back to the topic of specific impulse, let me just look at some drawings here. And I'm going to explain why my electromagnetic propulsion systems are way off the chart here. Because let's just look at the definition a little closer of specific impulse. And here's what it amounts to. It has to do with the burning of fuel. It's assuming that you're going to burn some fuel here. And what's going to happen with that fuel? It's going to go out a nozzle in one direction, and the spaceship is going to go in the other direction. And just for simplicity of comparison, let's use two commonly used types of space fuel. We're going to use liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, which is like used in the space shuttle main engine. And that's what most people are familiar with. If you're, you know, if you're old enough to have seen a space shuttle launch, or you can, of course, still see them on videos. But going back to the old Apollo, the grand launch of the Saturn V rocket, you know, it lift off the launch pad very slowly, burning millions of gallons of fuel in a second. And it might be a slight exaggeration, but a lot of fuel went out those engines in a short amount of time. Okay, and so they were burning, the Saturn V was burning kerosene and liquid oxygen in the main stage. So hydrogen, which is much better specific impulse than kerosene, but kerosene is cheaper. You don't have to freeze it. You don't have to keep it at very low temperatures to keep it in the liquid form. So kerosene, that's what the Russians still use, by the way. Their big heavy lift rockets that are going off into space every day, the Russians are shooting off rockets. And of course, you don't hear about that in the Western press at all. But kerosene and liquid oxygen, they both use liquid oxygen. The kerosene versus hydrogen is really the comparison here. So how are their specific impulses? How do those compare? So just to make mention here, then, let me put it this way. Let me just give a little more precise definition. The mass is the weight flow rate in pounds per second. This is in the English units of measure. And so, in other words, it's a rate flow of material out of this thrusting engine. And the thrust is the actual force in pounds. And then this leaves the unit of specific impulse to be in seconds. So it's the rate of mass flow per pound of or pound of thrust. And so you have a comparison, and this is related to the energy that's created in the burning process. So when kerosene mixes with liquid oxygen and it burns, how much thrust do you get out of that compared to the weight of hydrogen? And so it turns out that hydrogen is a better fuel, but it's harder to manage. But that's, of course, when you're spending billions of dollars in a government program, that really doesn't matter a lot. Okay, and so the end result here, and I'll get to some specifics here. In fact, I'm going to go back to, if you're being bored here, just hang on to your seats for just a minute, because I'm going to go back to the continent, the lost continent of Atlantis in a couple minutes here. And I think that will spark your interest. Okay, as far as getting into outer space, etc. And this, once again, it gets back to the electric highways to the stars. And my book, Atlantis to Tesla, goes into a lot of this detail. And there are a lot of people who read that book and they don't really quite understand it. But it's a very revealing book because it talks, in the person, a well-trained physicist will read that book and get a lot different insight out of it than you might if you're not a well-trained physicist in the art of understanding space travel and things like specific impulse. But I'll break this down for you in a minute, and what does it really mean to you? So anyway, hydrogen would be a better fuel just from the thrust point of view. But what if you didn't take any fuel at all? And you go, wait a minute, how can you do that? And that's the whole point of electromagnetic propulsion systems, because there what you're doing is you're creating, you have a basically a nuclear battery, and I describe how to do that also in my talks. So these were given at private military meetings back in the 1980s, the early 1990s, that I attended invited speaking venues. And it was kind of funny because some of these officers got very haughty with me. They got very belligerent. And it looks like, well, see, what you're doing here is because they're in the military and they're tier one scientists and they're supposed to be the top smart guys on the planet. And you come in with an idea that they never thought of. Of course, what they have to do is put you down because they're smart and you're dumb. And that's the way they look at things. So they have to treat you and look down at you because in the military, their position is to get dumped on from above and to dump on the people below. And that's the way the military works. If you have the perfect right to downgrade, to belittle, to dump on in any respect you wish to people underneath you. And if somebody is above you in the military, you have to cower there and accept it. And no matter how rude or how belligerent they are with you, you have to accept it. But hey, I wasn't in the military. I'm civilian. I'm an independent scientist, buddy, and I don't have to take your baloney. I am not an underling to you. I'm not a buck private in your military. I'm an independent scientist, and I don't have to kowtow to your view, your worldview. Let's put it that way. Anyway, just a little side note, a little historical background there of how these things were presented into the military communities. But, okay, so what if you don't have to take any fuel along? What happens to specific impulse? Because it's expecting you to run your spaceship with an inertial engine by pushing fuel out the back of a nozzle and going in the other direction. But what if you're doing something that where you're using energy? And let me use another common example here. Let's use another example. Say a couple of examples. Say you're a squid. Let's say you're a squid. And you take in water and you shoot it out the back end, and that makes you go forward. And so when you take in the water, that water is part of your system now. That increases your mass. And then you have to shoot it out the back end, and that makes you go forward. Okay, so that's a squid. But what about just the regular swimmer, a fish or a person in the water? You are expending energy. You're moving your appendages. In the case of you, it would be your arms. in the case of a fish, it'd be those little floppy fins up in front and then the tail moving back and forth as fish swim. And but you're not exuding mass. You're pushing against something, and that's the water. You're by the way of your motion. And what are you doing when you're swimming? You bring your arm back to maximize the contact with the water. And by the way, that's why you wear fins, and that's why some people for swimming have these little gloves. They're like a web, and you bring them together as you're going forward, and then you expand your hand, and you get a much better thrust with your arms and hands because you got this web out there, whereas before it was just your hands and your feet, etc. But anyway, you are expending energy by moving your arms and legs, but you're not expelling any matter in the opposite direction for you to go forward. So you are not an inertial propulsion system, in the fact that you are not, that part of your mass is not going out to make you go in the other direction. So what are you doing when you're swimming? You're pushing against something that's there. It's water. What if you could push against a magnetic field? And you can. And that's the point. But if you didn't know there was a magnetic field there, what caused the magnetic field, then you would never come up with this. And that's why I could come up with it, because none of the other planetary science, space scientists, astrophysicists, etc., none of them had a clue that there were electric fields in outer space. And they had kind of a clue that there were magnetic fields, but back when I was doing this, they were really clueless. They didn't have a clue about magnetic fields, etc. And, you know, especially for the general planetary object in the solar system, they had no clue. So how would anybody ever invent an electromagnetic propulsion system if you didn't even know there were magnetic fields out there? Okay, so anyway, that allowed me, once I understood the electrical nature and the electrical discharges that were going on, and whenever you have an electrical discharge, it naturally creates a magnetic field. And so this is where we start getting to the point of Atlantis. What the heck were those people doing back there? Well, I described this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. But anyway, back to the idea of specific impulse, just to clarify and round out this idea. How could you compare an electromagnetic propulsion system to an inertial engine? And it's because, let's take another type of propulsion in outer space. It's called the ion engine. Now, how does that work? You take along a high mass atomic species in bulk, and what you do is you heat it up, and then you ionize it. You can use, ultraviolet light would be one mechanism for ionizing your vaporized material. Now it's in vapor form. It's in a container. You ionize it, and then you develop an electric field down a ramp, down a tube, and these ions accelerate down the tube, and they go out the other end, and it's a form of inertial propulsion system. You're shooting something out one end, and it's making the spaceship go in the other direction. And so you're, in a sense, you're using electric fields. These are static electric fields that are built up within your spacecraft to make the particles move in one direction. So it's a different version of the chemical rocket engine. Instead of using chemicals that burn and get hot and go out a nozzle, you are causing velocity, momentum transfer between these ions that are going out one end, and typically they're very low thrust. When I was going to the military meetings back in the mid-80s and in the early 90s regarding these propulsion systems, the ion engine was just on the drawing board. People had these little models, and they were on a table, an exhibition, and they were the first examples of using an ion engine for space travel. And since, they've become quite common, because what happens, you use a very small thrust for a long period of time, and it's the equivalent of a short burn of a very high, you might call it high octane or high energy content chemical fuel. It's just a different way of achieving the same result of going in one direction as fast as you can. And so ion engines are commonly used. However, they are still inertial engines. They use the transfer of momentum between one throwing something in one direction at a velocity so you can gain velocity in the other direction. So let's look at, say, for example, say you're out in outer space, you got a spacesuit on, you've got your Flash Gordon little propulsion system on, and you press the button and it burns a chemical, it goes in one direction, you go in the other direction. All these are inertial propulsion systems. Something has to go in one direction so you can go in the other direction. And so if you're comparing inertial propulsion systems like the kerosene Saturn V rocket with the space shuttle hydrogen rocket, both of them burning oxygen, and say they're burning at the same rate. Let's say they're burning oxygen at the same rate. That would be our apples-to-apples comparison. How would hydrogen do versus kerosene? And, of course, the hydrogen is going to give you more energy overall, given the same amount of oxygen in the engine. The hydrogen is going to do better. It's a more efficient fuel. It's faster burning. You're going to accelerate faster. And that was one of the things that was very visible. If you were used to seeing the Saturn V rocket take off, the moon rocket, back in the 60s, the Apollo program, etc., in the early 70s, it would kind of rumble and it would sit there and it'd lift off very slowly and start moving up. And eventually it would gain speed, but it was like this slow lift off, you know, dramatic. Whereas the space shuttle was zap. It was off the launch pad and up in the air and gone, out of sight. Well, kind of out of sight. It was on a smoke plume, but it took off the launch pad in a hurry. It was no waiting around. Okay, so anyway, comparing those specific impulse of those two rocket styles, but they're both inertial engine types. They both heat up matter. The matter goes out the nozzle. They go in the other direction. Inertial propulsion systems. Okay. One little question here. Could you use an ion engine for a major liftoff or like a heavy lift rocket? And the answer is no. No, you would not be able to do that. It's very low thrust. And it has to work over a very long period of time. So you're not going to use an ion engine, for example, to lift off a large payload into outer space. Okay. So now we come to, once again, the rocket problem in that the fuel becomes payload. As the rocket is burning, that big Saturn V or the space shuttle engines are burning, everything that's not burning is payload. And that's why they start going faster and faster. The same amount of thrust is coming out the engine, but the payload is being reduced because you're burning fuel. And so as you're burning fuel, the weight of the spacecraft becomes less. So the force that's opposing it, the force that's pushing upwards, is the same. But the mass of the spacecraft is being reduced. So you start going faster and faster and accelerating, etc., and to the point where you're up to about, let's say, 10 miles up, where you're up to about, say, 50,000 feet. And that's the point at which the heavy lift rockets, they have to keep going slow because they're in the thick part of the atmosphere. So that's another part of the equation here, is that you have to continue moving very slowly because if you get going too fast, the wind resistance, the air resistance, becomes too much, and you're just burning up fuel trying to go fast. Now, this is part of the whole philosophy of runway to launch, runway to orbit, to low Earth orbit, the philosophy of taking off from a runway. Because if you compare, for example, the Richard Branson Virgin Galactic lift vehicle, which is the brainchild of Burt Rutan, he understood that getting up to 50,000 feet, the comparison between an aircraft, using wings and the aerodynamic advantage of wings, it's about a tenfold advantage for the amount of fuel that you use. So you can get up to that 50,000 foot, that 10-mile up range, with very little fuel compared to a heavy lift, vertical lift rocket. And so, and you can't go faster with the vertical lift rocket, but you can get going up to 600 to 800 miles an hour in the direction of orbit with the airplane at 50,000 feet. It's not a big deal for a jet airliner to go 600 miles an hour. And when you're talking about shaving off miles per hour by some other means, and if you look at my, for example, my hotel launch system, which is a runway to orbit lift system, it's the same thing. It uses it uses the chemical jet engines to get up to about 50,000 feet. Then it uses chemical boosters to get up quite a bit farther, about twice that high. Then it releases the payload. And so, and then it comes, the carrier vehicle comes back down and lands, and you can reload it. It's very inexpensive, very fast turnaround, etc. And so that's a whole nother story. But there again, when you're trying to put payloads into outer space, and if you can do this near the equator, then you're gaining another 1,000 miles per hour just because of the rotation of the Earth. And so if you add the jet going at, say, let's just say round numbers, you could get a jet up to 1,000 miles an hour before the release, and it's doing this at the equator, you have 2,000 miles per hour off the 17,000 mile per hour orbital insertion velocity. That's a big deal. That's a very big deal. And at a very low price tag with a reusable carrier vehicle that comes off of a runway. Okay, so anyway, I'm not going to start comparing that apples and oranges. That would be like peaches, apples, and oranges comparison, because they're very different. So anyway, let me just speak specifically also about the different types of rockets here, because probably not a lot of you are familiar with these. When you're dealing with chemical rockets, you have the solid fuel, you have liquid fuels, various types of liquid fuels. I already talked about hydrogen and kerosene, and the solid fuel boosters. There's different combinations for those. What they were using on the space shuttle was a combination of rubber and sulfur and aluminum. If you, it's kind of like the way you would make this up. This would kind of be like a home recipe for rocket fuel. You'd take car tires, grind them up into little small kind of powder. Then you would take aluminum cans and equally grind that up into small powder. And then sulfur, just good old at the tip of a match sulfur. And you would blend those together into kind of a solid paste. And then you would cast them in a long tube with a hole up the middle. And so what it does is it burns from the inside out. So you light it. And this is just like the little kids' rockets that use more like kind of a gunpowder type of chemical mixture. Estes was the rocket company. I don't know if they're still in business, but people still play with those, building rockets for fun, little rockets that go off. And I built a Saturn V. Actually, it was a Saturn 1 rocket, I believe, and it had five Estes rockets, some of the bigger rocket engines, and that was kind of interesting because there was a second stage on that also, and then it had a parachute that would blast out at the very end. They had a secondary charge up in the front of the little engine that would blow out the front, and that would blow the top off the little space tube. And out would come a parachute, so when it fell back down, it would fall back down with a parachute. Interesting. Little toys for little kids. Okay, so we have chemical rockets. Then there's nuclear thermal types of rockets. And gas core nuclear, that's another type. And the these are where you actually use nuclear heating to heat up the ejection material. And then now as you move down the chart here on specific impulse, you start getting into things like solar thermal. Now, why does solar thermal work better? Because you're not carrying along the material that is causing the chemical reaction. You're getting the energy part of it from solar energy. So that makes it in terms of specific impulse, you're getting a lower thrust, but you're getting a higher specific impulse. And so that's an interesting form of engine because you are extracting energy from the sun, which is in a sense free. Then you go down the chart further, and there's nuclear electric ion. And so that's back to the ion engine principle and plasma effects using nuclear fuel. And so you're using nuclear fuel to create the electric field and higher temperatures for the plasma material that then is shot out an ion engine. But then again, you're starting to move into lower thrust engines with higher specific impulse. So there's kind of a trade-off here. But then the question is, where do you fit the electromagnetic propulsion systems? Because this is a whole new animal. All of the engines I just described, whether they're chemical, thermal, nuclear, solar thermal, nuclear electrical ion propulsion, whatever, all assume that you're going to throw something out the nozzle. These are all impulse engines or inertial engine systems. They all depend on you heating something up or creating some kind of effect, an electrical field, a static electric field, where you throw something out the back of the rocket and the rocket ship goes in the other direction. But that's not the case with the electromagnetic propulsion systems that I invented. And once again, nobody else could invent these because they didn't know that there were electric fields in outer space. And so anyway, that gave me the impetus. But then there was a whole other part of taking those electric fields and magnetic fields that result from them. And that's why you call them electromagnetic propulsion systems, because they use both. They use both electric fields and magnetic fields, because to get a magnetic field, you need an electric field, which causes current to move, and the magnetic fields push against each other. It's like when you take a magnet, if you have a magnet in your hand, one in your left hand, one in your right hand, and if the north poles align, then those will latch together. Those magnetic fields will combine and cause a magnetic field that's double the original magnetic field, so they add together. But you can also make magnetic fields push against one another. Tremendous force in magnetic forces. For example, a mag train is a good example where there's a small space between the rail and the vehicle, so you eliminate friction. Now you're moving along a frictionless track. There's another form of frictionless rail system in that it uses forced air, but it's a bit more costly. And what happens, we used to use these in the laboratory to do experiments. And basically it was a freshman physics lab, but you had a rail system, very exactly made, very exactly tuned, and very precisely flat. And it was actually in the shape of a V, and you had little holes every maybe couple inches or maybe every inch, I don't remember, but you would hook this up then to basically a vacuum in reverse. You know how you can take your vacuum and hook it up so it's blowing out air instead of sucking in air. And so there would be forced air coming out the track. So these little cars, these little flat-bottom cars, would ride along the rail, and you could push them, and they would kind of go forever because there was no friction. So it was a way of studying inertia and laws of physics, etc. Okay. Also, you could measure little g, the force of gravity, by putting them at a slight angle. And knowing that angle, you could calculate the force of gravity by just measuring the acceleration, etc. But back to the mag rail, the idea of a magnetic rail is that you levitate the train using magnetic fields because they're very strong. Once they get close, those things are not going to touch. You can put all the weight on that mag train you want, and it'll never touch that track. That's how powerful those magnetic forces are once they get close. They're short range, but very powerful. Okay. In another, let me just go through this also. There's some of the most powerful cannons in the world are magnetic cannons. And so the idea with a cannon is to shoot a projectile, get it going very fast so that when it comes out of the muzzle of the cannon, it goes the farthest distance. And, of course, that's the whole principle of a cannon. But with the magnetic cannons, what happens is it's a you create a magnetic field, and then there's two parts to this. There's the electric field, which is between the left and the right rail, and then you have a magnetic field that runs along this track. And so what happens is you drop a bar along the over the two rails, causing a short circuit between the plus and minus DC, causing a DC current to flow. And this is getting very close to the electromagnetic propulsion system, by the way. And that rail, that rod, will just accelerate down the track because you have an electric current. It's called the right-hand rule. These are perpendicular forces in the physics of electromagnetism. And that object will shoot down the rail at very high velocity, accelerating. And so the most powerful cannons in the world are actually made upon this principle. Okay, so now we're getting very close to the electromagnetic propulsion systems. But like I said, if you didn't know there were outer space magnetic fields, why would you ever invent a magnetic propulsion system? Well, you wouldn't. You wouldn't even think of it. It wouldn't make any sense. There wouldn't be any reason to build one because you didn't understand that there were magnetic fields in outer space. So I had to jump on everybody because of my understanding of the electrical nature of the solar system and the universe, and also understanding that the part of the physics of fusion was in separating charge and creating basically in the solar wind a non-uniform flow between the protons and electrons in the solar wind. So there was an excess current of protons, which ultimately created the solar capacitor. And then that solar capacitor could discharge, and when it discharged, that's where the magnetic fields come in. So a large comet, for example, just to give you a preview here, a large comet would be an excellent staging ground, so to speak. It's electrical discharge of the solar capacitor because it's concentrating along that object. And this is one of the bizarre and very interesting and really, in a sense, godlike characteristics of the electromagnetic propulsion systems is because, let me use another example. Imagine you were Columbus and you were out in the sailing across the ocean, or one of the ancient mariners, or you were one of the Spanish ships taking trade back and forth between the New World and the Old World with your square-rigged sailing ships. But what would happen if, when you started sailing, all the wind concentrated on your sail? Wouldn't that be a good deal? But the way it is, only your Only the wind that hits your sail is going to push you along. But in the world of electromagnetism, it's different. It's very interesting because the spaceship itself concentrates the current sheet that you want to ride on. It's a property that is almost, it's like the Indians up in the Native Americans. I guess some don't like to be called Indians because that's a misnomer. They don't live in India, which I can understand. They're Native Americans. And even Native Americans is probably the wrong term because Vespucci Americana. What was his name? Vespucci Americo. Americo Vespucci? What was the guy's name? Anyway, I'm grabbing at straws here. Was the guy that America was named after because he was the map maker. He was a sailor, etc., and a navigator, and was one of the very early explorers of the American coastline. And so, yeah, that's why we are called America. It has nothing to do with the poor Native Americans. And so that's even a misnomer for them. That was some Italian guy sailing along the coast. Anyway, but what if your sailing ship, you got out into the middle ocean and all the wind concentrated on your sailing ship? Well, that doesn't happen. But as I say, in the world of electromagnetism, it does happen. And what a godsend, because now once you start traveling and riding on the electric rivers concentrate on your spacecraft. They are pulled together, and they concentrate, increasing your available magnetic field. And so I'm sure there's some physicists out there thinking, you know, that and they're not understanding. Most of them probably don't understand what I'm talking about. But anyway, this is the way it works. And it's really amazing. Oh, I know why I was talking about the American Indians, the natives, is because they believed that cedar and birch bark, for example, were gifts from the gods. Because cedar was easily worked. It was very resilient. It was resistant. If you built a canoe out of cedar with birch bark around the outside, these things would last for decades. And so for an Indian that took all that labor to make a canoe, these were not throwaways. And then in the wintertime, they would take them and they would submerge them. They would put rocks in them, and they would submerge down below the waterline where they would keep moist. As long as they kept wet, they would last darn near forever, which is the opposite of most things in nature. If you keep most things wet, even steel ships, they will deteriorate. But not a cedar ball, birch bark canoe, they will last longer and longer as long as they keep wet. Anyway, the point is that the Indians, the Native Americans, both misnomers for that those groups of people, believed that the cedar was a gift from the god because it was so special to them. It was what made them made their lives easy. Without cedar, they made baskets, they made their houses framed from cedar, and it was very easy to cut. It was a soft wood, very strong, very resilient, and the fibers would run. They could make long pieces of fibrous material. It was just a wonderful material. It was flexible, but not too flexible. It was just, like, perfect. And so anyway, cedar was a gift from the gods. Well, the same thing. The electric currents to the electric highways to the stars are gifts from it's a godsend. And it is, it's also something that, people simply didn't understand. And even today they don't understand. They're still trying to build chemical rockets, if you can imagine that. How absolutely absurd. I don't want to go into that tonight. I get off on a tangent on that and I may never come back. Okay. So this leads us up to which I talked about the railgun, which is very similar to the electromagnetic propulsion system, but there's some idiosyncrasies here. In a laboratory, you have a fixed magnetic field. You can control that magnetic field. But in outer space, you have free magnetic fields. If you create another magnetic field, you affect the magnetic field that's the plasma magnetic field of outer space that you're trying to push against. And so you are altering the environment that you're working in. So this is a very strange set of circumstances. So this has to be in the spacecraft design, you have to overcome this little idiosyncrasy. And that's one thing that I happen to do in the design. And it's very simple, and I'm not going to go into this on detail. This is where most even well-trained physicists get lost, is how to deal with the fact that you are dealing with a plasma magnetic field and not a fixed magnetic field like a bar magnetic field. There's a way to deal with. And then there's two types of propulsion systems that are electromagnetic. There's the active, and that is the one that I describe in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. That was the one that I was presenting. Remember I told you that the snobby military guy got up, and he was a young guy, but he was probably like up by like colonel or maybe a general or something like that. Really a arrogant guy, the guy that got up to kind of give me grief. But the military meetings that I was presenting these in were very high level. This is where the top electromagnetic propulsion experts of the world got together to discuss these ideas. And so the other part of the system was the electrical generation, and how did that work? That was also part of the system, but that's something I did not give them. I held that back, believing and knowing to myself that this thing would not work without that other piece of the puzzle, in which they've never been able to figure out. So it, in a sense, they tried to steal my technology, but they only were able to steal part of it because I didn't give them the other part. But the more subtle aspect of electromagnetic propulsion is in the passive, the ones that do not require any input energy from the system. And so this is something similar to, let's say, a solar sail. It's a different principle because they were dealing with electromagnetic fields and not solar pressure. But if you can extract energy from a system just by putting something there, and it's not an inertial propulsion system, it's not a active propulsion system in that it is doing something. For example, a swimmer is an active propulsion system. He's doing something. He's making some motion. So that's another qualification. The swimmer is a non-inertial propulsion system. He's pushing against something that's there. That's the water, or the fish, or the person, but he's not ejecting material, and in that sense is not an inertial propulsion system, because the squid is different, because the squid takes in water and then shoots it out the back, and then takes in water and then shoots it out the back. And this is part of any of these systems also, which is very interesting comparison between the outer space electromagnetic propulsion system example. And that is that, for example, the swimmer loses some effort by moving his arms forward. But you do it in such a manner that when you push to go forward with your arms and legs, you're maximizing the thrust. And then when you bring your arm forward, you're doing it in a sense like outside the water. And so then you have the least amount of resistance in getting back to the point where you're going to create more thrust with your arms, for example. So that's why swimmers, they swim on the surface of the water. But a swimmer underneath the water, his arms are not that useful, because you got to bring the arm forward, and there's almost as much resistance involved in bringing your arm forward as there is with bringing it in the thrust direction. So underwater, you're better off just using your fins. And there again, you're pushing against. But the end result is that you're not extruding your mass to make you go forward. You're not an inertial propulsion system, but you're an active propulsion system. You're actually doing something. Whereas the square rig sail is not out there. It's not flopping around. It's not with sailors pulling on it. It's not like oars. It's passive. It's just there. It's collecting energy that's already there in the wind, and it makes you go forward. So that's the ideal long-term space propulsion system. It's non-inertial passive. Okay, so I hope you're listening to this. Why is this important? Because if you're older, you're going, well, I'm not going to go into space. Well, maybe you should teach your kids, because there's a lot of effort today. Kids need to be interested in something. Kids need to be interested and active. They're running around. They got energy. They're going to burn it in some direction, so make it a good direction. And outer space is a very good direction, or surfing, or riding bicycles. That's why kids ride bicycles, because it's a lot of energy and it's a lot of fun. And it's a very positive thing to do. It's good for your body. It's good for your health. It's fun. You get to go places quicker. That gives kids mobility. One of the things that all people seem to want is mobility. And so that's the same in outer space. So now I've brought you through this whole issue of electromagnetic propulsion systems, starting out with the concept of specific impulse. Now, your average guy, if you go to the office tomorrow, or you talk to your friends or something like that, you're on the phone talking to somebody tomorrow, say, hey, by the way, what's your opinion of specific impulse? You're probably going to get some blank stares out there, buddy. You know, what do you mean specific? What's my specific impulse? Is that, what do you mean? You know, am I supposed to be offended? What do you mean, what's my specific impulse opinion? Anyway, just a little bad humor. Physicists have very bad humor. Only physicists can laugh at physics jokes, I think. You're starting out with specific impulse, understanding that is a measure of thrust based on the mass flow that's occurring in your inertial engine. So it assumes that all space travel has to occur by an active propulsion system that is inertial. So what I'm saying is no. Get away from that inertial stuff, because carrying that payload of mass to heat up and throw out the back end, even if you got the most efficient, highest temperature nuclear rocket on the planet, you have the same issue. That you got, say you're going to go to the next star system or, beyond. You're going to go traveling out in the galaxy with your inertial nuclear rocket propulsion system. You're not going to get very far, buddy. You are not going to get far. And what's going to happen if your engine goes out? I'm afraid you're going to be floating in space for a long time before anybody drives up with a tow truck to haul you off to the next star system. So anyway, that's why a passive non-inertial propulsion system is the way to go. And it's kind of like, this happened to the sailors too. They would get caught in what were called the doldrums. That was an old sailing term. And if you got caught in the doldrums, you could sit there for weeks and not get any place. And this was not a good time, because it was usually in the tropics. It was usually hot and humid and no wind. And you had temperatures that might have been, 100 degrees. And you're sitting out on this wooden ship with the sails hanging down, waiting for the slightest breeze to push you along. And you're running out of fresh water. It's not raining because you're in the doldrums. Usually if there's rain, there's wind, there's storms and wind. So it's dry, you're running out of water, you're running out of food, and, I tell you, this happened. And people would come across this ship out in the middle of the ocean with a bunch of, let's just call them dead people. And they died because they got caught in the doldrums. It was one of the greatest fears, alongside of rogue waves. Those were the two things, greatest fear or some sea monster, Moby Dick, that would come into the side of your boat and crash it and sink it, out in the middle of the ocean, or falling overboard, because these square-rigged vehicles There's a good example of that in that one of my favorite movies, Russell Crowe, Bastion Commander, The Other Side of the World. One of my favorite movies. Won an Oscar for cinematography. Should have won an Oscar for acting and just the whole movie. Should have gotten more Oscars. But it was Lord of the Rings. It was competing against Lord of the Rings, if you can imagine that, being in the movie business. But anyway, I digress. A very good example of what it was like living on a sailing vessel back then. Life was not easy or fun. But anyway, the whole idea is that there are very efficient ways to travel in outer space. I've discovered them, and I want to pass these things on to the next generations as a free gift. But I don't want them going to the military or the other aspects of, the military-industrial complex. And that's why I got distanced from my own project developing these back in the early 1980s, is because I did not want to cooperate with using them for military hardware. And I was very vocal and open about that. And of course, that's the first thing that the venture capital people want to use it anything for, because that brings in the highest dollar, the highest return on investment. And that's what venture capitalists are interested in. It's all about the money. How much money can we make on this? Well, you're going to make the most money if it's used for military. And so I've sat in meetings and I told people that, and they looked at me like I was the man from Mars. What do you mean not use it for military? That's what we do. That's how we make our money. Our money comes from our profit, our return, our ROI, return on investment from the venture capital groups. That's what they live on. And so anyway, no, I was not popular, you know, for and being displaced from your very own project because of ethics. Good grief. That doesn't happen very often. Okay, well, I'm about out of time. It turns out that my sale on the MR5s on the sale page is still there. I got requested last week from other groups, not necessarily my audience, but from some other groups who just had heard about the sale, and they had called in and could I keep the sale up because they didn't get in under the timeline. I said, okay. So in fact, it's still there, the 10% sale on the webpage, the jmccwaterfilters.com webpage. There's still the 10% sale, and as I understand, the JMCC code is still good until the 5th of September. I pushed that out so those same people could benefit from there. So if you didn't get under last week's sale, but it is going to end because here's what's going on. I have other marketing methods that are going to be using up that percentage of the profit. And I can't give a profit and those two times, let's say that way. So go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. The 10% sale is still there on all the products, plus JMCC coupon code at checkout. Put that in and you get another 10%. And I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week and maybe see you in outer space one of these days. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.